Chapter 20. Present day. Ryan follows me to the door of our motel room, but doesn't step outside. I turn around, lean in, and kiss him gently. "I won't be long," I say in a soft voice. His arms wrap around me, pulling me close.
"You sure you're okay? Don't want me to come with you? You may need another getaway driver."
My laugh is loud enough to feel real. "I wish, but this is something I need to handle alone. Plus, I know you need to check in with work. Gotta keep all those old ladies happy." He peppers me with quick kisses while his hands roam.
"Call me if you need me."
One last kiss and I'm walking away. Ryan watches me from the open doorway until I turn out of the lot. Today is important, and I need to clear my head and remind myself why I'm here. I have some time before my next stop, so I drive around in a random sort of way to center myself. It also gives me time to identify who's tailing me and screw with them. Because I know someone is back there. Since the Tate job, someone has always been there. My mind wanders back to that job as I cruise through a neighborhood. I think back on that complex security system that guarded some stuffed dead animals, a cabinet of cigars, and not much else. That was not as much a job, but more a twisted game where he pit us all against one another. Devin had watched that house as religiously as Mama had watched Victor Newman in The Young and the Restless. Never missed a second. He studied who came in and out. He made sure I was aware of every camera, so I had the least amount of screen time. And he identified every person who came for the painting. When the painting was delivered and my fee had been deposited, it was time to move on. But I couldn't stop wondering about the others who showed up and failed. I couldn't shake my curiosity about who they were and whether they wanted more from life than moving from job to job like I did. Because Devin is Devin. He sent me exactly what I wanted almost before I had to ask for it. He didn't even make me feel weird when I said I wanted more than screenshots of them from the video feed. I wanted names and addresses. Mr. Smith sent six of us into that job, and I wanted to meet them all. That was the first time I had ever been that close to learning who else worked for him, and I didn't want to waste this opportunity. I knew it was possible that not all of them would want to talk to me, but I was hoping to get to speak to at least a couple of them. We may have been competitors on the Tate job, but why couldn't we be allies going forward? This was not the first job that I realized the value of having someone on my team who answered only to me. And this time, I would have been one of the failures if it hadn't been for Devin. I convinced him that it wouldn't hurt to reach out to them. We could combine resources and brainstorm strategies. We could build a community. At the end of the search, Devin could only give me one name and address. I drove all the way to Cape San Blas, Florida, between jobs. Walked up to the cutest little pink house, where half a dozen wind chimes hung from the front porch, and the doormat had a drawing of the sand and surf, and the words, "All we do is beach, beach, beach," printed on it. That search for the others who attempted the Tate job, and the conversation with the one person I did manage to talk to, changed everything for me. For the first time, I wanted to quit this job, this way of life, flee and start a new life, one with purpose, like Andrew Marshall spoke of that morning in South Carolina. The shiny gloss of this life had worn away, leaving all the scratches and dents behind. But it isn't a job where you turn in your 2 weeks' notice. Not if I ever wanted to go back to being Luca Marino and everything else that meant. So I stayed. I kept taking the jobs he offered, like I had an option to refuse them. When I was sent to Louisiana and given the name Ryan Sumner, I thought I was prepared for the job ahead of me. In theory, it's easy to believe I could handle whatever he threw at me. In reality, there was no way to prepare myself for what he did. Mr. Smith struck where it hurt the most. It's too late to run, so I need to see this through. I finally arrive at my destination and find a spot to park. After I throw some quarters in the meter, I duck into a CVS to buy a prepaid phone, a single-dose pack of Advil, and a bottle of water. There's a headache building behind my left eye that I need to get in front of. Leaning against the back of my car, I balance the phone against my shoulder once I hit send, so I can use both hands to throw back two pills and chase them with water.
Devin answers on the second ring, but doesn't say a word in greeting. "It's me," I say.
21 C Hotel in 1 hour. Coffee shop in the lobby.
Number?
515.
And then he ends the call. It's a short drive to the hotel, and thankfully I find a parking spot around the corner from the front door. In addition to this being a hotel, 21C is also home to a museum, so the lobby is teeming with people, and I'm forced to weave through the crowd, dodging rolling bags and swinging briefcases, until I get to the coffee shop that sits to the right of the main entrance. A huge banner hanging over the hall that leads to the convention rooms catches my attention. Re-elect Andrew Marshall. Promises made, promises kept. I skip the long line for coffee and find a small table where I have a good view of the lobby. 45 minutes later, a smile stretches across my face when I see Governor Andrew Marshall stride through the front door. There are quite a few people with him, two who I recognize from my short time in his employ. Early polls show he'll win his re-election by a landslide, and his name is already being batted around as a potential presidential candidate. I leave my jacket on the table, so no one takes my place, and walk toward them. He spots me when I'm about 10 feet away, and I can see recognition dawn on his face, even though I look different than I did 6 years ago. He separates from his group and closes the distance between us.
Mia?
He asks. Yes, Governor. It's me.
How have you been?
He asks. I can tell he wants to reach out in some way, to hug me or shake my hand. But neither seems right under the circumstances, so he ends up shoving his hands in his pockets. I'm good. I've been following your career. I couldn't be prouder. He shrugs.
I had some good advice early on that I believe has helped me tremendously.
I take a deep breath and ask, can I speak to you a moment in private? One of his aides has materialized next to him. I'm sorry, but Governor Marshall has a tight schedule. He's due to speak at a luncheon in just a few minutes. She has a hand on his arm and is trying to pull him away, but he stops her.
Margaret, it's fine. I have a few minutes.
I gesture to the coffee shop and he follows me back to the table I saved. Once we're both sitting, he asks,
are you in trouble? Is that why you're here?
I give him a tentative smile. Maybe a little. I'm okay, for now. Andrew leans forward, his elbows resting on the table, his voice dropping to an almost whisper.
I owe you, and we both know it. What can I do to help?
Shaking my head, I say, I'm not ready to call that favor in yet. Just need to make sure it's still on the table, and you're still willing to give it. We stare at each other while he tries to read me, but I'm giving nothing away.
If it is in my power to help you, I will.
I nod, knowing this is the best I'm going to get from squeaky clean Andrew Marshall. That's what I needed to hear. And now enough about me and my problems. How are you? He leans back in his chair, his eyes never leaving mine.
I'm good. Balancing the job and the re-election campaign. So it's a busy time. But I have to ask, Mia, are you good? Happy?
God, if he only knew. A few rocky spots left to smooth out. But I'm getting close. This gets me a smile finally, although it's smaller than I wish it was. He glances at his watch, signaling our time is up. You need to go, I say, making it easier for him to leave. Andrew stands up and pulls a card out of his pocket, then hands it to me. I study it while he says,
my private cell. Just let me know what I need to do.
And then he's gone. I drop back down in my seat and watch him walk away. Holding the card in front of me, I read it over again. A loud screech pulls my attention from the card, and it lands on the man dragging out the chair Andrew just vacated. It's George. But instead of the UPS uniform, he's dressed in a dark suit. He drops down in the chair, catching the flicker of surprise that washes across my face before I hide it away. You look good in a suit. He smiles and says,
you're supposed to be in Atlanta.
I'm working my way there. Needed to make a couple of stops first, I answer.
What are you doing?
He asks in a soft voice,
His concern for me is apparent.
You're playing with fire. Andrew Marshall won't do anything that gets his hands dirty. We both know that.
My eyes never leave George's face. I don't know what you're talking about. I was just passing through town and thought it would be nice to catch up with a few old friends. He frowns.
You can lie to everyone else, but don't lie to me. Not after all this time.
Then you don't ask me questions you know I can't answer. George rubs a hand across his mouth, then says,
Mr. Smith thinks you need a bit more incentive.
I let out a loud, frustrated breath. Are you going to send the detectives another picture of me on a public street?
Not me, he says. I'm just the messenger. The next set of images will make it increasingly hard to get you out of trouble. He's not playing around.
I nod slowly, considering his words. Any other messages you need to deliver? His eyes crinkle at the corners as he really thinks about what he wants to say.
Just one from me. Head to Atlanta. You can still make it to the bank and get into that safe deposit box by tomorrow afternoon. Give him what he wants. I don't want to do what he'll ask me to do if you don't. Please, Luca.
This knocks me back a bit. This is the most candid he's ever been with me. All I say is, thanks for the heads up. I stay in my seat while he rises from his.
Tell your guy he's getting sloppy. I clocked him coming in through the service entrance in a maintenance uniform.
He always calls Devin my guy. Devin and George have played their own cat and mouse game over the years, trying to figure out who the other one really is. But I don't think either have been successful. At least I know Devin hasn't been. Wish we could have gotten that drink, I say.
He laughs. Get your ass to Atlanta and maybe we can.
Just as he's about to walk away, he turns and adds,
Good luck.
I shrug and give him a smile. Who needs luck? His laugh carries with him out of the coffee shop. I sit frozen in my seat another 10 minutes, running through our conversation over and over. The urge to run floods my system. But running means I'm looking over my shoulder not only for Mr. Smith, but for the police, for the rest of my life. Finally, I get up and head to the elevators. I hit the button for the 8th floor once I'm inside. I walk down the hall to the door that leads to the stairway. I go up and down by elevator and stairs 3 more times until I end up on the 5th floor, and I'm positive no one is following. Knowing Devin, he's had the cameras monitoring this floor on loop before he walked into the hotel. I knock on the door to room 515. Devin opens the door and says,
The look of shock when George sat down was a nice touch.
He told me in Fort Worth that eyes are everywhere, but I never know if it's him or someone else watching, so I was a little surprised when he sat down. I sit in the chair next to him. He said you're losing your touch. Saw you come through the service entrance. Devin's upper lip curls back.
Does he think I just coincidentally entered the building the second y'all arrived?
He rolls his eyes and adds,
He only spots me when I want him to.
Devin has a monitor and printer set up on the hotel room desk, and I study the images he has on the screen. Andrew and I are in the frame, but we are not the main focus. George is. While I'm chatting with Andrew, he is in the lobby, sitting in a wingback chair, holding up a newspaper, but watching me. I'm assuming George got audio too. Was he able to hear everything Andrew and I said? Devin pushes another couple of buttons and replays the conversation between Andrew and me.
Yeah, the old man in the Titan's cap. Guessing the mic was in his cane, since he handed it over to George on the sidewalk outside the hotel after he left the table.
I find him on the screen, and sure enough, the cane is leaning against his table, angled toward me. I wasn't sure how Andrew would react when he saw me, but it was the best I could have hoped for, I say. It was a risk coming here. But it was clear 6 years ago that he felt like he owed me one, so I was confident that sentiment would resurface. I just needed him to say it out loud, and he didn't let me down. I'm also sure Mr. Smith will interpret it the way I want him to. He won't think Andrew would help me just because he's a nice guy. He'll think Andrew has to because I've got something on him. Mr. Smith always thought I got dirt on Andrew Marshall, but kept it for myself. Which is why it's so easy for him to believe I did the same with the info on Victor Connolly. He thinks I retrieved it from Amy Holder and kept it for myself instead of turning it over to him.
Renting the safe deposit box seems to be what threw my loyalty into doubt. And a guilty verdict means the only thing keeping me from taking a nosedive into the nearest body of water is the contents of a 5x7-inch box locked behind a bank vault door. Is Connolly just sitting back and waiting? Or should we be worried about him? I ask. A few keystrokes and the screen changes.
So far, he's sitting back. But I'm keeping a close eye on him.
I stare at a picture of the man in question. From my own research, I know he's 67, but he looks older in the images Devon has collected. What little bit of hair he has left is completely white, and years of sun exposure have not been kind to his skin. But while he may look like he's some aging old man, there's no doubt he's extremely dangerous. Connolly's businesses are a mix of legitimate and illegitimate, as you would expect. You have to show how you can afford the fancy cars and private planes and houses scattered around the country. But the substantial income he claims on his tax return is nothing compared to what he brings in through nefarious means. This is why Mr. Smith is going to such great lengths to make sure Victor Connolly remains a happy client. And I don't need Mr. Smith making me the sacrificial lamb to Connolly if he starts to become unhappy. So now, Devon and I are on the offensive. I knew Mr. Smith had more evidence against me, but I didn't want to wait until I was sitting across from those detectives to find out what it was. So I'm forcing him to burn it now. He thinks he's going to scare me by sharing the rest of what he has on me with the police. But I'm glad I'm flushing it out while I can still do something about it. While I still have a chance to run if I need to. How soon before you have Mr. Smith identified? I ask. The detour to Oxford had three purposes. First, I wanted to look a bit unhinged. Wanted Mr. Smith to feel like I was out of control and worry about where I would go next. It's harder to anticipate a person's next move when they are acting erratically. Second, we needed to determine how clients get in touch with him. I knew Coach Mitch would only have one person to turn to when I came knocking. Hello, King Harvest. And lastly, we still don't have Mr. Smith's true identity, and we need that more than anything else. By discovering the fan site and Mr. Smith's username, Devon is backing his way through the system, hoping to find something that will lead us to him. I'm close, is all he says, and I don't push for more. He pulls out the handwritten pages I left for him under the Twinkies yesterday.
It's not your fault he killed the woman and James.
I nod, even though I should have known he'd go to those lengths, and I should have said more to her that night before she left. Warned her in some way. You still think we should bail? He takes in a deep breath, then lets it out while his eyes scan my face.
I'd rather bail and regroup than continue down a path that leads to you either being thrown in jail or killed.
I'm shaking my head before he finishes. Bailing now doesn't save me from either of those options. The ding from the computer behind him interrupts whatever he was going to say. An alert has him changing the screen to show he's finally gotten into the Atlanta PD system.
I'll pull up the file on Amy Holder, and we can see what they've got.
A few images fill the screen, and Devon says,
according to the dates of these entries, these images were uploaded a month before you got to Lake Forbing, so they have to be the ones that supported the material witness warrant.
We both move closer to the screen to get a better look.
This pic of you dragging Amy from the car is not your finest moment, he says.
It couldn't be helped. He continues to click through the images.
You do a really good job of angling yourself away from the camera. Did you know where your shadow was?
George is rarely the one who follows me around during jobs, unless it's a particularly important one, like when I was on my own for the first time for the Coach Mitch job. Being my shadow is a lot of downtime, and I'm sure he's got more important things to do. Most times I can pick out who's watching me, but other times, like that night, I couldn't. It was too dark to see anything farther than 3 feet away. Shaking my head, I say, no. I mean, in most of these situations, I had a good guess of where they would be, where I would be if I was the one watching.
Okay, here we go. New images were just added to her file. So let's see what Smith sent in. You must have really pissed him off. He didn't waste any time.
The note attached to the pics makes it look like it was sent by a detective from another department who stumbled upon this critical piece of evidence while investigating another case. And while Devon could probably wipe it from their server right now, Mr. Smith would just resend it later. Best to leave it in play. With a few keystrokes, we can see the latest piece of evidence against me. It's a video. He pushes play, and there I am. Chapter 21. Present day. It's late afternoon when I pull into the motel parking lot. I see Ryan pacing back and forth in front of the open window of our room, phone to his ear. He ends his call, then steps outside as soon as I'm parked. Before I can shut off the engine, Ryan is at the car door.
I kept trying to call you.
I can tell he's agitated I ghosted him all day. I texted that I called the motel office earlier and got us another night, I say, then lean in to kiss him before he can respond. We stay tangled up for a few minutes, long enough to soothe any worries that there is a problem between us. Sorry, that took longer than I thought it would. There were decisions to be made and plans to put in place once he watched the video. I have to hand it to him. Mr. Smith has all but turned the key in the lock on my jail cell. Ryan follows me into our room and watches as I pull out a change of clothes from my bag.
I talked to Rachel earlier, he says. She'll be in Atlanta tomorrow afternoon. She was hoping we would get up early and head that way, so you two could have a little time to prepare before the interview on Friday. Looks like it's around a 4 to 5 hour drive.
Okay, I'm going to get cleaned up.
Hungry?
He asks. Starved.
There's a pizza place on the other side of the gas station next door. I'll run over there while you're showering.
He steps close, giving me a quick kiss, then leaves the room. Moving my stuff to the bathroom, I dig through my toiletries bag for some Advil. My headache from this morning is back. I can tell the bottle is empty before I pull it out. I hesitate a second about whether to call Ryan and ask him to pick up some for me, or to just head to the vending machine in the elevator corridor, where I know there is an assortment of single-dose packets like I bought this morning. My head is pounding, so I opt for the vending machine, since the pizza could take a while. I'm still dressed, so all I need to do is slip into my shoes. I'm almost to my destination when the conversation drifting from the open space where the vending machines are makes me pause. It could be any of the guests staying here, but my gut tells me to be on alert. I inch closer. Leaning against the brick wall behind me, I slow my breathing and close my eyes. I invite my other senses to take over, hoping to pinpoint what has me feeling like this. Deep breath in. Deep breath out. Two voices, both male. One much deeper than the other. I relax into the space. Open myself up to the sounds only a few feet away. Words float my way. And it's easy to pick out the ones that hit home. Atlanta. And Amy Holder. I slide my phone out of my back pocket and text Ryan. Me. Stay at the restaurant until I tell you to come back. Please don't ask questions. I press send, and then hear the familiar chime coming from the same direction as the vending machines. What the hell? The faint rumbling of voices continues as I watch the small dots jump around as he replies. My ringer is off, so there's no sound once it's delivered. Ryan.
Okay, let me know what you want me to do. Fuck. Something's got her spooked.
Ryan's voice fills the space, and I freeze. They've moved a little closer to me. And then another voice I recognize.
Did she say what's wrong?
George. He's talking to George.
No. I need to get back. I'll let you know when we get to Atlanta. And if she doesn't make it on time tomorrow?
George asks. I take a deep breath. No, no, no. Not this.
I'll let you know what I want to do. I don't like all that information out there like that. I'll wait to hear from you,
George says.
And here, pick this up, but couldn't get it to you before you left town.
I quietly take a few steps away, then hustle down the side of the building back to our room. My phone vibrates in my hand, alerting me to an incoming call just as I'm opening the door. Ryan's picture fills the screen. I don't answer until I'm inside. Hey.
Hey, what's happening? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Freaked myself out. My voice is frazzled, but I'm hoping it plays to what I'm telling him, not because of what I've discovered.
I'm coming back. Hold on, I'll be right there,
he says, and ends the call. I shuck off my shoes and jeans, then move into the bathroom. I cut on the water in the shower before wrapping one of the thin white towels around me. I give myself a moment to take several deep breaths in and out to slow my racing heart. Then I hear the door opening.
Evie.
I poke my head out of the bathroom. In here. He's by my side in seconds. His arms pull me in and close around me like a vice. I force mine to do the same to him.
What happened?
If I didn't know who he had just been talking to, I would be flattered by his concern. I squeeze my eyes closed and count to five. Another deep breath in, deep breath out. It's nothing, I swear. I heard something outside. Ended up being one of the janitors banging around out there. Opening my eyes, I see our tight embrace reflected in the bathroom mirror behind him, and papers rolled up like a tube shoved in his back pocket. Those must be what George handed him. I watch the mirror disappear as steam from the shower fills the tiny space. I count the seconds between the drops of water as they leak from the faucet. Because I have to separate myself from this moment, need to focus on something other than the desire to react to what I just heard. Need some space between him and me, if only in my mind. Ryan's mouth is next to my ear.
You okay?
His actions are exactly as they should be, and I mentally scroll through each and every moment we've shared, starting with the first one in the parking lot with my flat tire, scrutinizing them with the certainty of his involvement. I nod, not trusting myself to speak. He met with George. He talked to George with the same familiarity that I would. There were so many times when I felt like Ryan was a whisper away from telling me every secret he'd ever had. He even talked openly about his business in Texas in the car. There were many times I teetered on the edge of confessing everything. But he was playing me, while I was ready to risk everything for him. The sorrow clouds my vision, my thoughts, everything inside of me. His hands slide up my body to my face. He pulls back so he can look at me. His eyes search mine as mine search his.
It's not like you to get spooked,
he whispers. He's right. Did he study me the way I studied him? Was there a sheet that said she enjoys sweet potato fries and two sugars in her coffee? I've been fighting a terrible headache all day. Then I heard a loud noise and it got the best of me. I look toward the shower. I better get in before I run out of hot water. He runs his hands down my back once more, then steps away.
I gave the cashier an extra 20 to deliver the pizza to us, so it should be here by the time you get out.
I can't lock the door when he closes it behind him, because that's not something his girlfriend would do. I step into the hot water, and it's the jolt I need, like a punch in the face. It clears the haze, but does nothing for the grief that has settled in my veins. I am gutted. I give myself 5 minutes to mourn the possibility of us. 5 minutes to grieve what could have been. 5 minutes to destroy the idea that it was possible that I was the kind of girl who could live in a perfect house with a perfect guy on a perfect street. And remember, this is not my world. I'm just a ghost who drifted through it for a bit of time. When I'm back in the main room in fresh clothes and wet hair, Ryan is clearing off the small table for us to eat on. I was starving half an hour ago, and now the thought of food makes me want to throw up. But I sit at the table and choke down a slice. I fill the silence with mindless chit-chat, because that's what his girlfriend would do.
I'm worried you won't have enough time with Rachel to be prepared for Friday,
he says, after taking the empty boxes to the dumpster outside. Those papers aren't in his back pocket anymore, and I'm hoping they didn't get thrown away too. Rachel and I will have plenty of time, promise. I climb in the bed, burrowing deep in the covers. It's cold in here. Can you turn the air down a bit? Ryan moves to the unit under the window to adjust the temperature. He rummages around the room a few minutes, then heads to the bathroom. It's not long before he's crawling into bed next to me. I let him pull me close. He doesn't speak and doesn't push for anything more. We're connected from our head to our feet, and I can feel the steady beat of his heart where it's pressed against my back. There are a few moments where I think he's gearing up to say something, but words never surface. I replay the conversation between Ryan and George over and over and over.
You seem distracted. Want to talk about what's on your mind?
The whispered question so close to my ear feels intimate, like we're really in this together. I'm just tired. He doesn't push for an answer, but instead runs his fingers through my hair, just the way he knows I like. It's a while before either of us fall asleep. Chapter 22. Present day. I'm up before the sun. It took me forever to fall asleep last night, and when I finally did, I was restless. Ryan always sleeps hardest in that last hour before he wakes for the day. So this is the best opportunity to look for the papers he had when he came back from meeting George. Ryan's grip on me has lessened during the night, so it's easy to slip out of the bed without waking him. Crawling across the floor, I make my way to his bags. He's got the duffel with all his clothes, shoes, and toiletries, and a laptop bag for his work stuff. I've been through his bag a number of times, dug through the files on his computer, and checked his internet history. But other than the things I've already found for Mr. Smith, he's careful about what he leaves lying around. Now I'm realizing it's because he knew I'd be looking. I only found what he wanted me to. So stupid. But those papers George gave him should be here somewhere, unless he read them and then threw them out with the pizza boxes. The air unit under the window kicks back on and drowns out the sounds of his bag being unzipped. The laptop comes out first, since it takes up the most room. There's a yellow legal pad he takes notes on while he talks to clients, and a spiral-bound prospectus on some mutual fund I've heard him push on a few of the calls he's taken since we hit the road. A stack of papers are tucked away in the inside pocket. I go through them sheet by sheet, most of them relating to the financial services business, and I'm preparing myself for the possibility that they aren't here, until the edges curl up on the last few sheets in the pile, as if its muscle memory has kicked in. These were the ones that were rolled up. Spreading them back open, it doesn't take me long to recognize what this is. Alarm bells slam through my head. This is the last batch of information I left for Mr. Smith. Devin had slipped it to me in that People magazine, and I'd gone through it to decide what I wanted to turn over. The small handwritten note in blue ink in the bottom corner of the last page, where I tell him I will check the box again the next day, lets me know this is the original, not a copy, since all I had in my purse was a blue ink pen. This shouldn't be here. I turn around and take in Ryan's sleeping form, and the puzzle in my head starts to rearrange. Even if I consider that Ryan is higher up the ladder than I am, he shouldn't have this. Not the originals like this. Not delivered to him by George. Not when it sounds like George picked them up from the mailbox and brought them directly here. To him. The idea that Mr. Smith wanted this business for himself seemed like the most likely scenario. But what if it's more than that? There is no danger of me screwing up the hostile takeover of a business he already owns. No reason to keep me on a job that's not a job at all. My mind races, tripping over theories and speculations and suspicions, while the air conditioner purrs and Ryan sleeps. The meeting between Ryan and George yesterday confirmed a couple of things. George knows where we are because Ryan told him, and the way they interacted with each other spoke to a closeness that only forms over time. I've been trying to put a face to Mr. Smith for years. Turning to look at Ryan 3 feet away, it's hard to believe he could be the boss I've grown to despise. No, that's not right. He's too young. Timeline doesn't match up. As I shove everything back in the bag the exact way I found it, I mentally scroll through every conversation with Mr. Smith. The first time I talked to him was 8 years ago. Ryan was still at LSU and has no connection to North Carolina. Mr. Smith handed me off to Matt, who I dealt with solely over the next 2 years. I didn't speak to Mr. Smith again until after the Andrew Marshall job 6 years ago. 6 years ago. Ryan's grandmother fell ill with cancer 6 years ago. Ryan stepped in to handle the trucking business, both the legal and illegal side, for his grandfather, so he could stay home to care for his wife. and eventually took over the business fully after he died not long after. Was that all he took over? No. No. Ryan is going to Atlanta with me, where I'll talk to a bunch of cops. Would he open himself up like that? And then I'm back at the Bernard's house in my mind, seeing that small room where we answered every question asked of us, where that detective learned Evie Porter was from Brookwood, Alabama, because Ryan told them.
Evie moved here from Brookwood, Alabama a few months ago. She didn't know James.
No, no, no. And then Monday morning in the garage, where Ryan lingered, and I ignored the 911 message from Devin, because Ryan wasn't ready to let me go. I remember thinking, had I not lingered with Ryan in the garage, I would have seen Devin's text as soon as I received it. Those few minutes may have cost me a clean getaway. But wait, no, Mr. Smith responded to Mitch on that forum after we left Oxford. Ryan was driving. I think back on the moment I saw the message come across. I was in the passenger seat of my car. Ryan had just filled it up with gas and gone inside for more snacks. He was in the store while I was watching the conversation between Mr. Smith and Mitch. The memory of the moment between Ryan and George boots up, and I watch it again through a different lens. The familiarity is still there, same as I would have with George. But it's Ryan making the decisions, George deferring to him, George delivering the papers to him. This job was a test. Testing my loyalty. And shit. Ryan would have known immediately that I'd altered the information on his business before I turned it over. He has direct proof I wasn't doing the job I was sent to do. And I was worried about him losing his business to Mr. Smith. I knew I would be watched closely. What better way to watch me than when I'm sharing the same space? No. Not going there. Not yet. While it's easy to jump to conclusions, it's also very dangerous to make assumptions. I crawl back to my side of the bed and snatch my phone off the nightstand and pull up Instagram. Scrolling through my feed, I stop on the Skims post recapping the five biggest news stories of the day and comment, "That is breaking news. Too hot for me to handle. Hashtag on the road again. Hashtag party of one." It's a good chance Devin won't see this for a couple of hours, but I need him to know I'm out of here and leaving Ryan behind. Once my comment loads, I grab my purse and keys, abandoning everything else. I had already planned to stop at Goodwill on my way out of town to get what I need going forward, so I'll just have to add a few more items to my shopping list. The click of the motel door opening echoes through the room, but luckily Ryan doesn't stir. I'm in my car and pulling out of the parking lot within minutes. As soon as I hit the interstate, I dump the phone I've been using as Evie Porter in Lake Forbing. And thanks to the little black box from Devin, if there is a tracer in my car, it's not providing any information. Before, I wanted Mr. Smith to know where I was going, but not anymore. Once I've been on the road about 2 hours, I stop to buy a prepaid phone and call Devin. "Hey," I say when it connects.
"What happened?"
he asks. I fill him in and we're both silent a few minutes. "You know what I'm thinking," I finally say, not wanting to voice out loud who I think Ryan really is.
"You know I'm thinking it too," he replies. "But no assumptions."
"We only deal in facts," I say before he can. This has been our mantra. I'm still in the parking lot of the store where I bought this phone, pacing the length of my car again and again. I tell myself it's because I'm stiff, but it's fear that's driving me.
"I'm back in Lake Forbing," Devin says. "I'll take care of my part. You take care of yours."
Before I can end the call, he says,
"I'm close on the message board. Keep that phone, so if I need you, I can get you, since I'm guessing you don't have access to your Instagram account. The risk is low enough."
I'm not sure what parameters Devin uses to gauge the risk versus reward in these situations, but I trust him enough that I don't question his reasoning. "Okay." I pause a moment, then add, "If it looks like things are not going to end like we hope tomorrow morning, haul ass. Drop what you're doing and disappear."
"Elle, you know I'm not abandoning you."
Between Mr. Smith and the cops, we both know the chances of me walking away from this are slim. And there are other people to consider. Heather, for one, will need you.
"Same goes for you," he says. "It's never too late to bail. Just get up and start moving."
I'll check in when I'm done today, I say, then end the call. This entire conversation felt so much like a goodbye that I couldn't bring myself to actually say it. It's mid-afternoon when I pass the Welcome to Eden sign. It was a long drive with only a stop to buy the burner phone to call Devin, and in Winston-Salem to buy some clothes at Goodwill. My eyes drink in the town I once called home. Memories flood in so fast that I almost drown in them. The fast food restaurant where I hung out with friends and the fabric store where Mama and I spent hours poring over new arrivals every week are still there. But those buildings have been ravaged by time and neglect. I turn on the road that runs in front of my high school, and it's almost physically impossible to breathe when I see the worn path through the grass between the side door and the parking lot that I traveled 1,000 times. The last time I was here feels like a lifetime ago. It also feels like yesterday. But as familiar as everything is, I am still a stranger here. There's no one I would call up and visit. One last turn and I'm on my old street. I pull into the trailer park and get out without cutting the engine. I study each one of the single wide mobile homes crammed into this space, comparing what they used to look like to now, and remembering who called each of them home. I save the middle one on the left side for last. I cringe when I think about how embarrassed Mama would be for anyone to see it in this condition. Even though it wasn't much to look at when it was ours, she always made sure it was neat and clean, and the narrow beds near the steps had flowers planted in them. Now they're full of weeds, and there's a blue tarp covering some damage to the roof, and a broken-down truck up on blocks next to the door. It hurts to remember the girl I once was, the one who called this place home. That girl was happy here. Really happy. Even when Mama got sick, that young, naive girl thought she could take care of her, thought she could save her from dying. But that little girl learned a lot in that trailer. She learned that no matter how hard you try, sometimes it's not enough. She learned the only person you could trust, the only person you could rely on was yourself. A woman peeking out from behind a curtain in the trailer closest to me reminds me I didn't drive all this way for a walk down memory lane. There is one reason I came back to Eden. Once I'm in my car, I turn around and hit the main road again, stopping at Sheets to refuel and do a quick wardrobe change in the bathroom. Then it takes only a few minutes to get to the newer area of town, where the businesses sit in a long row behind plate glass windows. I park near Dr. Brown's office at the far end of the strip and make my way to the door. "Can I help you?" the receptionist asks when I approach the counter. "Yes, property management sent me over. We're checking the breakers and all the units. There was an electrical problem in the pet store last night, but thankfully someone was here to get it under control before it started a fire. Shouldn't take but a couple of minutes." I was lucky enough to find a uniform shirt and a pair of khakis at Goodwill that I could make work so I looked the part. "Oh," she says, motioning me to pass through. "Of course. Let me know if you need anything." I give her a big smile, then head toward the back of the office. Luckily, all the employees are with patients in the exam rooms, so I go unnoticed as I slip inside the mechanical room. I bypass the electrical box, going straight for the main server and inserting the drive from my bag, then running through the keystrokes Devin wrote down, guaranteeing the files are uploaded. I'm out of the room in 5 minutes. Moving back to the reception area, I nod to the girl at the desk. "You're all good. Enjoy your day." I'm leaving Eden for the last time 10 minutes later. Calling Devin, I say, "It's done," the moment he answers.
"Sending you a screenshot," he says. "The coach Mitch gamble paid off. We know who Smith is now."
My heart rate skyrockets, and I pull over to the side of the road as I wait for the image to load. And there he is. Even though the screen is tiny, his familiar face is all I can see. I stare at it longer than I should. Finally, I put the phone back to my ear. "We deal in facts now," I say.
"Yes, we do."
He pauses, then says,
"This doesn't have to change anything, El."
I swallow hard. "I know. Make the calls. I want to get through the cops first. Then I'll worry about the bank. If I can't shake the cops, the rest of it doesn't matter. So they are the priority right now."
"Okay. Remember what I said. It is never too late to bail. Just start walking."
I'm nodding, even though he can't see me.
And you're handling things in Lake Forbing?
Already done. Got in the house without a problem. I'll tip the police off first thing in the morning,
he says.
And the next river you pass, toss that phone in. Don't have it on you when you meet with the cops.
Will do. I'll grab another one when I get to Atlanta, so next time you hear from me should be after I'm done with those detectives. And if I can't call, you'll know.
Nope. No doomsday talk just yet. I'll wait to hear from you.
And then Devin ends the call. I stare at his image a few more minutes before deleting it. Alias, Regina Hale. 6 months ago. It's the first time I've been bored on a job. I'm in Decatur, Georgia, and the only thing I've been given was my new identity, a membership number for the local country club, and the name Amy Holder, along with a set of instructions. Amy Holder is in possession of some extremely sensitive information regarding Victor Connolly and the Connolly family business. She is threatening to use the information against Victor in exchange for money. I cannot stress to you enough how crucial it is to retrieve this information before she can make good on her threat. You are being trusted with this job, and confidentiality is imperative. Neither of us want to get on the bad side of a man like Victor Connolly. You are to watch Amy Holder and learn everything about her. Do not engage until I tell you to, but be ready to act at a moment's notice. Like clockwork, Amy pushes through the double glass doors of the bar at 5:25 p.m. For the last 2 weeks, she has stayed home until around 5 in the evening. Then she commutes a measly 2 miles to this country club, where she'll drown herself in vodka martinis until closing. Amy is 5'7", with an athletic build and honey blonde hair that hits right below her shoulders. The makeup is light, the jewelry is non-existent, and she rocks a perpetual resting bitch face. By the time she slips onto her favorite stool, a bartender with a name tag that reads Morris, in a pressed button-down shirt with the club's logo, delivers the first of many drinks with a warm smile and a cheerful hello. Devin has definitely gotten more comfortable in playing an active role over the last few years.
Would you like to see a menu, Miss Holder?
He asks. Maybe a little later, she replies.
Of course. Just let me know when you're ready,
he replies as he walks away. This exchange is also a constant. Same question, same answer. She won't ask for a menu, and he won't offer one again. But all it takes is a slight nod, and her glass will be refilled within seconds. I've been in and out of this bar for the last 11 days, but it's the third night in a row that I've settled in for the duration, not bothering to hide anymore. She sips her drink and ignores everyone around her. If she has a phone, she has not once taken it out and looked at it. There's not a single person here, myself included, who hasn't glanced at their phone at least once, even if it is just to check the time. But not Amy. Amy will sit at the bar and drink anywhere from 4 to 6 martinis. Then she'll grab her purse and drive the short distance home, some nights swerving back and forth across the yellow line the entire way. She lives in a townhouse that is worth more than it should be because of its location. She'll wake up the next morning and start the whole process again. And since there is no way to get inside her house without losing sight of her, hanging around this club is my only option. From my place across the room, I track groups as they come and go, just as I've done night after night. The bar area fills with members heading in from rounds of golf and tennis, as they either celebrate or commiserate over the day's game. The restaurant caters to the families looking for a dinner out. Both areas are loud and chaotic. This sitting around and waiting is getting to me. Usually I get a little lead time before a job starts, but within 24 hours of getting word from Mr. Smith, I was crossing the city limits into Decatur. Because of the frantic nature of my arrival, I assumed I would be making contact immediately, but I have been instructed to do the exact opposite. And now 2 weeks have gone by, and all I've done is watch her drink her dinner. That doesn't mean I don't know what's happening here. The reason I'm in a holding pattern is because someone else is working behind the scenes trying to make a deal with her to return the information on her own. Not that they are playing nice, but because it's the best way to make sure they get back everything she took. The only thing protecting Amy right now is that she is still in possession of the blackmail material, and regardless of whether she turns it over willingly or I have to take it from her,
The second it's out of her hands, she'll feel the full wrath of Mr. Smith and the Connolly family. And just as I was warned after the Tate job, I have no illusions that I am alone here. Amy Holder has become the number one priority to Mr. Smith, so there will be nothing left to chance. I move to the bar, choosing a stool 3 down from hers with a big open space between us, and signal for another glass of wine. Devin sets it down in front of me and asks,
"Would you like to see a menu?"
With a smile, I say, "No, thank you." And he moves off to help a group on the other side of the bar. Even though I'm not sure if I'll need him for this job, I've gotten to where I don't want to do a job without him. We've become an inseparable team.
"You're new here," Amy says.
I take a minute to glance around to see if she's talking to me. When it's clear she is, I answer, "Yes. Just moved to town." I turn on my stool to face her, opening myself up to a conversation. She scans me up and down, then turns back to her martini.
"I know what you're looking for, but you're not going to find it here."
She swirls a finger in her drink and then brings her finger to her mouth, sucking the liquid off it.
"You won't find it. Tell your people."
I can't help but shrink back from her outburst. Amy brings her glass to her lips and takes a deep drink, finishing it off, then waves the empty glass in the air.
"You'll never, ever, ever find it."
She's loud enough that several heads turn her way. She spins around to face me, gives me a big toothy grin, then turns back to the bar.
"Gone,"
she shout whispers. I identified the guy who was sent to watch me watch her a few days ago. Older guy who stays in the back corner of the room, dressed like he's just finished a round of golf. I know there's a high probability he's sending Mr. Smith real-time updates on what is going down right now, so I have to tread carefully, since I was told not to engage her. I don't want to be taken off this job.
"I believe you have me mistaken for someone else.
I don't know what you're talking about," I say, then turn back to face the bar, taking a sip of the wine in front of me. Mr. Smith will be pissed I'm the reason she's losing it. Watching her in my peripheral vision, I see her shoulders deflate, almost as if she's frustrated with me. I watch her for several seconds, then she beams when another cocktail lands in front of her.
"Morris, my hero," she squeals.
The crowd's interest in her dies down, and the volume rises as the conversations around us resume. I swivel just slightly in her direction so I can watch her a little more easily. She notices I've turned and she follows suit.
"The first time you showed up at the club was Monday before last at 6:17 p.m.
You wore a light blue tennis skirt and white sleeveless top, hair pulled back.
You ordered a vodka cranberry.
The next night you got here at 5:45 p.m. wearing a floral shift dress. You had 2 glasses of Chardonnay." She's pointing the plastic drink stirrer at me while she rattles off the exact arrival time of each visit I've made here, including what I ate, drank, and wore, her volume increasing as she goes.
"And every night, your midnight blue Lexus SUV follows me home."
She even recites the license plate number. I'm glancing around the room, noticing we've attracted an audience again. My shadow in the back corner is openly staring at us. The only other time I've been confronted like this was by another drunk woman, Jenny Kingston. Images of her lying on the floor, blood pooling around her head, flood my memories, along with the question my boss asked me after. What would you have done if she hadn't fallen on her own? It's a question that has haunted me for 8 years. I have to try to salvage this situation.
"I'm new to town, and this seemed like the best place to meet people."
"I get it," she says. "I know they want it back, but we both know I'm dead if I turn it over."
I glance around the bar, looking for any cameras or mics so I can determine just how much Mr. Smith will hear about what went down tonight between us. There's nothing obvious, but I can't rule it out, so I keep up the charade.
"I'm not sure what you're talking about, but if you need help, I can—"
"You're not here to help me. No one can help me, but I had no choice. I'd already be dead if I didn't take it."
She doesn't give me time to respond, but instead says,
"Just go away already,"
before settling back into her cocktail. I stay at the bar long enough to finish my wine and close out my tab. Then I slide off the stool and walk out of the bar.
Once I'm in my car, I drive on autopilot to the small apartment that was set up for me. There's no doubt Mr. Smith has already heard about the scene we made in the bar. I don't think what happened tonight would be enough for him to pull me out, but he'll be watching closer than ever now. It's 3 days before I make my next move. I'm hiding across the street from her house, awaiting her arrival home. The second set of instructions came the morning after Amy confronted me at the country club. I was right. Mr. Smith was not happy with me. Timetable moved up due to your inability to follow simple directions. Use whatever means necessary to locate and retrieve any digital device, including cell phone, computers, tablets, hard drives, etc. If it can store digital information, take it from her. I shouldn't need to remind you how sensitive this information is and how you are to handle it. I've thrown away any semblance of being subtle, and the warning there is clear. The information I recover is for his eyes only, or I'll find myself in the same place Amy Holder has found herself. I'm not to befriend her, get close to her, draw things out. I am to take everything from her, immediately. Amy's headlights shine across the yard as she swings into her narrow driveway, the right side of her car barely missing the trash can. It's a 5-martini minimum night for sure. The car cuts off, but the driver's door doesn't open. Minutes tick by, and she's still not out of the car. I wait until 10 minutes pass before I leave my hiding spot and slowly walk down the driveway to where she's parked. As soon as I get close enough to the car, I see her slumped form draped over the steering wheel. Opening the driver's side door, I catch her before she falls out onto the concrete. I dig through her purse to find her keys, shoving them in my pocket. Grabbing Amy underneath her arms, I drag her from the car and up the driveway. She loses one shoe and then the other. I almost want to flip off the camera I know is pointed at me, but I resist and keep my body turned away from the street as much as possible. It's slow and steady until we get to the front door. Blessed silence meets us as I get the door unlocked and open. I don't stop moving until I get her to the couch. Once she's lying down, I go back outside and grab her shoes and purse and take a moment to search her vehicle. It's as clean and empty as the day she drove it off the lot. I start snooping around her house because, at this point, I wouldn't put it past Mr. Smith to have someone peeping through the windows to make sure I do. The house is as immaculate as her car. There was no technology here. There is a landline phone, but no cell, computer, or tablet of any kind, and no chargers that would indicate the tech exists but is just not present. There is one television, but the only channels it receives come from the antenna attached to the top. I check all the usual hiding spots, but it is as if nothing past 1980 has ever entered this house. I even search for notebooks or notes or scratches of paper in case she went the old school route. Nothing. I sit in a chair and watch her sleep for a little longer, before finally calling it a night and letting myself out of her house. Amy relocated to a hotel in downtown Atlanta the day after I searched her house. That was 4 days ago. I'm in my car watching her stumble out of a corner bar the way she does when she's had at least 4 martinis. I'm getting new instructions almost daily, since Amy's behavior is changing just as rapidly. The latest tells me Mr. Smith has lost all patience. Amy is out of control. Bring her in immediately. Non-negotiable. Bring her in immediately. This is new for me. And bring her in where? Do I grab her and wait for someone to approach me? Stuff her in my trunk? Mr. Smith is acting as erratically as she is. He is freaking out. And I have to wonder how much pressure he's getting from Victor Connolly to resolve this matter. Hopping out of the car, I cross the street, maintaining a reasonable distance behind her. Amy steps into the street as soon as the crosswalk turns green. Her bright red coat billows behind her as she knocks into people not getting out of her way fast enough. She nearly trips on the curb when she gets to the other side. She's making a complete spectacle of herself. Ignoring the group of sightseers ahead of her, she barrels her way across the sidewalk in front of her hotel. Amy pauses there, and I veer to the right so I'm off the street, but not standing too close to her. She's planted herself right in the way of foot traffic, and she's jostled by the pedestrians trying to move past her, spinning in a circle until she comes to a stop facing me. Her eyes lock on mine. The recognition on her face is clear. She raises her hand, pointing a finger at me, You. What are you doing here? I thought I told you to go away.
I shrink back a few feet, edging toward the corner. But before I can slip away, she moves a little closer and yells,
You can go back and tell that cocksucker Smith to go fuck himself. He's not as clever as he thinks he is. He's been screwing over people for years, and I've got all the details. I've got so much shit on him, more than he even knows.
A scowl stretches across her face, and then she flips me the bird before turning around and waltzing into the lobby of the hotel, as if she didn't just lose it out on the street. The shock of what she just said about Mr. Smith washes over my face. Then I school my expression into the blank slate I've spent years perfecting, because I know I'm being watched right now. I scan the street, looking for the older guy Mr. Smith has planted here. This will be the first he hears that sensitive information she stole wasn't just from a client. He will, no doubt, be furious to learn this. He barely trusts me to see what she took on Victor Connolly, so there is no way he would have sent me on this job if he thought there was a possibility I would be retrieving information on him. The last thing he would want would be for me to recover something that could be used against him, something I could use against him. For years, I've been looking for information on him, anything at all that will clue me into who he really is. He's right to worry about what I would do if info about him came into my possession. You do whatever you have to do to save yourself and the job. That piece of advice Mr. Smith gave me early on has stuck with me. It's the advice I let guide me on every job. This job is far from over. I follow her inside, sticking with the plan I've made. It takes a few minutes to get to the door that leads to housekeeping. I find a bag in one of the supply closets that has a hotel maid's uniform stuffed inside. I change quickly, then pull my dark hair up in a tight bun. Digging through the bag, I find the mic and earpiece at the bottom. Once I have the mic clipped to the inside of the collar of my uniform and the earpiece pushed inside my ear, I'm ready to go. Devon is usually against this type of tech since it's easy to pick up the frequency if you're close by. But there was no way to get around it. I'm ready. In the earpiece, I hear Devon say,
Good to start. Be careful.
He got inside the building yesterday to hack into their system and is now working from a van parked at the curb. He'll have one eye on me and the other on the hotel security feed. The plan is to freeze the camera when an area I need to move through is empty. Then he'll unfreeze it after I've passed through. I'll work my way through the hotel in stops and starts, invisible to the cameras above me. The cleaning carts are pushed off to the side, where they wait for the graveyard shift to restock them, since all the rooms were cleaned hours ago. I grab the closest cart, shoving my black duffel into the space left for dirty linens, and call for an elevator.
Elevator is empty. I'll wait for the hall to clear before I open the doors.
Copy, I say. The doors open, and I push the cart inside, pressing the button for the fifth floor. When the elevator doors open, I move the cart out into the hall.
Hold there,
Devon says.
Amy has just gotten off the main elevator and is making her way to her room. We need her on that camera, so I'm not cutting it until she's inside.
I check my watch. What's taking her so long? She should have already made it in. My gaze bounces from one end of the hall to the other, praying no one decides to come out of their room right now. I don't want one single person mentioning the presence of a maid with a cart on this floor at this time of day.
She's at her door, on her fifth try getting the key card in the slot.
Good grief, I mumble.
Okay, she's inside. You are good to go.
And I'm off, pushing the cart down the corridor, then turning toward Amy's room when I get to the main hall. Skidding to a stop in front of her door, I rap on the door and yell, Housekeeping! It's less than a minute before Amy opens the door. I don't give her a chance to say anything. I just shove the cart through the door, backing her up with it, then let the door swing shut behind me. Chapter 23, Present Day. I arrive at the Westin Hotel in downtown Atlanta right on time. Rachel is waiting for me in the lobby, although I can tell she isn't happy I've cut it so close. Since I was a no-show for the reservation made for me at the Candler Hotel, and I blew past the deadline set for me at the bank, I had to time my arrival just right. I wasn't sure you were going to make it, she says as I approach.
I spot the figure standing a few feet behind her. I gave you my word I'd be here, I tell her.
Can I talk to you?
Ryan asks as he moves closer to us. Rachel says, he called me and said you ditched him. I don't miss the tone or the raised eyebrow, but I ignore it. I look at Rachel. Our appointment starts in a few minutes, right? Rachel glances at her watch, then motions for me to follow her to the elevator. Ryan, let us get through this and then we'll figure the rest out. Okay? She thinks we're having a simple lover's quarrel. I don't correct her. Ryan drops down in a chair in the lobby and watches us until the elevator doors close. When we reach our floor, I push Ryan from my mind and focus on the task ahead of me. How did you pull this off? I ask Rachel. I'm honestly amazed she was able to move the meeting from the police station to one of the meeting rooms at this hotel. She's good. I have to give her that. We were unaware there was a warrant out, and we traveled all this way to answer their questions. We're here in good faith to put an end to this misunderstanding, so a visit to the police station was asking for too much. I'm glad she's on my side for this, but having seen the video I know the police received, they probably went along with her request so they don't spook me and risk me not showing. Remember, she says as we march down a hall where the meeting rooms are located, do not answer anything unless I give you permission. Do not offer anything extra. I nod while she studies me. We're stopped outside of a door labeled Room 3. I was also going to tell you not to let your feelings show, but you have that down pat. This actually gets a little smile out of me, because God, if she only knew. She pushes open the door and I follow her inside. I was expecting a long table and chair set up, but this is cozier. It's a small room with a couch and two oversized chairs grouped around a coffee table next to a wall of floor-to-ceiling windows with an incredible view of the Atlanta skyline. The key here is that we're cooperating and have nothing to hide, she says, moving toward the center of the room. She registers my surprise at the room and adds, I liked the optics. How can anything bad happen in such a warm, inviting space? There's a fresh pot of coffee and a plate of blueberry muffins in the center of the coffee table. You take that chair, Rachel says, pointing to the one on the left of the couch. And I'll take this one. The detectives can snuggle together on the couch between us. I settle in while she drops her briefcase on the floor next to the table. Not gonna lie, I'm feeling underprepared. We haven't had a moment to talk about that day and how we're handling this. Leaning back in my chair, I cross my legs and say, I'm going to need you to trust me and follow my lead. She watches me from across the coffee table, and I know she has a ton of questions, but thankfully they remain unspoken. Before there's any time for awkward silence, there's a knock on the door. It's your show, Rachel says, then gets up to open the door, stepping aside so a man and a woman can enter the room. I stay in my spot, making them come to me for introductions and handshakes.
I'm Detective Crofton, and this is Detective West, the man says once they are standing in front of me.
From her spot in front of the other chair, Rachel motions to the couch and invites them to have a seat. Detective West glances at the couch, then at Rachel, and finally at me. She's realizing she won't be able to look at us both at the same time. They hesitate a few seconds, but eventually take seats on the couch. It takes another minute or so of them repositioning themselves and trying to get comfortable before they seem ready to begin. Detective West is a reed-thin white woman dressed in what has probably been her uniform of the last decade. White shirt, black blazer, black pants. A simple gold band on her left ring finger is the only piece of jewelry she's wearing. She's got those lines around her mouth that let me know she loves to pull on a cigarette. Detective Crofton is her exact opposite. He's a tall black man and was probably a linebacker in his former life, given his size. His shirt has a blue paisley pattern, and the tight cinch of the belt holding his tan pants up shows he's recently lost some weight around the waist. There's a simple gold chain with a cross hanging around his neck, and the peek I got of his socks right before he sat down tells me he has a sense of humor. Cats riding unicorns on a pale pink background. And then I wonder if this is a true representation of them. Or are they like me, hiding behind a mask? Because I was deliberate when I dressed this morning, striving to show them the image of me I wanted them to see. Plain white tee with jeans, zero makeup and hair pulled back in a ponytail.
I look easily 5 years younger than I really am. Can I offer either of you some coffee? A muffin? Rachel asks. Detective Crofton pats his midsection.
Not me. Strict orders to lose 20 pounds, and I'm still 5 from my goal.
Detective West pulls a small notebook out of her bag and flips it open. Let's get started, she says, ignoring the offer of refreshments, while Detective Crofton pulls out a small recorder and presses the red circular button on top. Detective West says in a deep, scratchy voice, Detectives West and Crofton questioning the material witness, Evelyn Porter, in the death of Amy Holder. She adds the date, location, and time before meeting my gaze. Rachel holds a hand up. I would like it on record that Amy Holder's death was ruled an accident, and that we are here cooperating with officials to clear my client, Evelyn Porter, of any part in what happened to Ms. Holder. Your note is on record, Detective West says. Then she turns to me. Why were you living under the identity of Regina Hale in Decatur, Georgia, at the time Amy Holder died? She asks. Well, we're getting right to it. Forcing Mr. Smith's hand in short, he'd give them everything he could to bring me down. I look at Rachel and she gives me a small shrug, reminding me it is indeed my show. I was in a very toxic relationship and moved to put some distance between me and my ex. He didn't want me to leave, and I was afraid he'd come after me. I went to the police, but the only thing they were willing to do was give me a restraining order, and we all know how ineffective those are. So I used a fake name, hoping he wouldn't find me. This gives them pause. Rachel's left eyebrow raises just slightly, as if she's impressed with the answer. Where were you living when this happened? Detective West asks.
Brookwood, Alabama.
My boss went to great lengths to make me Evelyn Porter, lifelong resident of Brookwood, Alabama. So I'm putting it to work.
We'll need to call and check out that story with the Brookwood Police Department,
Detective Crofton says in a quiet voice. I nod. Of course. My ex-boyfriend's name is Justin Burns. His brother is on the force there. His name is Captain Ray Burns. Detective West scratches the information onto her notepad. If they did call, they will learn there is a Captain Ray Burns, and he does have a brother, Justin, close to my age. Justin has a record, too. A couple of DWIs and a disturbing the peace when the neighbors called the cops on him and his girlfriend fighting in the front yard. If they don't find a record of his altercation with me, they won't assume it didn't happen. They'll assume Justin's brother was able to keep that one off his record. The first lie wins. I am nothing if not prepared. Detective West seems to be the one in charge of asking the questions, and even though my answers so far seem to have taken a bit of wind out of her sails, she presses on. How did you know Amy Holder? We were both members of the Oak Creek Country Club, I answer. She checks off something in her notebook, as if she's going down a list of predetermined questions. There was no memorial service or funeral for Amy Holder. She was an only child and was not married, nor did she have any children. Are you aware of any family or friends she may have had? Rachel sits forward in her chair. We're not here to answer questions about Miss Holder's life. We were told you had very specific evidence that my client was at the scene. Can we cut right to that, please? Detective West shuffles through the papers in her lap. We're getting to that, Miss Murray, she says to Rachel, then turns back to look at me. When was the last time you saw Amy Holder? Here we go. I learned a long time ago to stick to the truth as closely as possible. I moved away from Decatur in early September, and I know I saw her before I moved, but I can't tell you the date. In fact, you can tell the truth if you word it the right way, using the right intonation. They will take I can't tell you the date as I can't remember it because of the tone I used, instead of the truth, which is I can't tell you the date because it would incriminate me. At 6:12 p.m. on August 27th, Amy Holder entered the American Hotel. 27 minutes later, her room was engulfed in flames, she says, her voice flat. Have you ever been in that hotel? I've eaten in the restaurant located inside the hotel, which is true. Detective Crofton pulls out an iPad. He lays it in the middle of the coffee table, and Rachel and I both lean in to see what's on the screen. He pushes the play button while Detective West says, This is the security feed of Miss Holder entering the hotel prior to her death. We all watch the grainy video of Amy shoving past a family of four as she crosses the street, then getting bumped by a guy who was looking at his phone instead of watching where he was going, which causes her to spin around. That red coat makes her easy to pick out, especially as she waves her arms around and throws me the bird. From this angle, I am in the background and slightly out of focus. The video finishes playing, and Detective West looks at me. The screen is frozen, and I'm just barely visible in the corner of the frame. Does this jog your memory, Miss Porter? Before I have a chance to say anything, Rachel answers for me. Are you insinuating that blurry figure in the back is my client? Half of the white women in the state of Georgia have brown hair. That could be any one of them. She leans forward and presses the button to replay the video. What I see is a woman who is clearly intoxicated. Miss Holder was a known smoker who died in a fire that was the result of smoking in her bed while drunk. If you have something that implies Miss Porter had anything to do with the death of Amy Holder, and for God's sake, an actual picture that looks anything like my client, we'd like to see it. Okay, damn, Rachel. I'm impressed. Detective Crofton flicks the screen to the next video.
This was taken by an eyewitness.
Downtown Atlanta is not a particularly busy hotspot during the week, although it can get pretty crowded on the weekends. Devin tracked down every piece of video from that day, from security cameras to videos on social media, that either tagged that location or a nearby business. We only learned of the existence of this video less than 48 hours ago, so I'm guessing the eyewitness and I share the same boss. The angle is directly even with Amy's room, taken from the building across the street, so there is a straight, unobstructed view, unlike the real eyewitnesses on the ground, who had to aim their cameras up and only caught a sliver of the room in question once the smoke started to pour out of the balcony window. The video opens to the camera panning the building until it stops on the open balcony doors of Amy's room. The balcony railing is a solid structure, so you can only see the top half of the room, the bed not quite making the cut. There's audio, but Devin and I believe it was added later, so it wouldn't seem odd that this video just happens to capture me in the moment it does. Detective Crofton turns up the volume, and we hear the guy's voice.
Hot maid alert. Maybe we'll get turndown service.
And then there I am, dressed in the hotel's housekeeping uniform. I'm deep in the room, but in plain sight through the open balcony doors. I'm looking down at where the bed would be if you could see it through the balcony wall. And it's a very clear image of me, unlike the one we just viewed. I remember that moment clearly. I had just pulled the box of matches from my bag and was about to run one across the striker. It was the moment right before the bed went up in flames. A few seconds pass, and the memory comes to life on the small screen. And then I'm obscured from view, as thick plumes of black smoke overtake the room.